Today from the Wings Archives. We've heard the term virgin birth in connection with Christianity, but it sounds to me as if you're saying that Christians didn't originate this idea.
Right.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service. This is Frieda Worden. It's almost Christmas of 2007 as my guest and I commence to talk by phone. Her name is Marguerite Rigoglioso. Hi, Marguerite.
Hi, Frieda.
Marguerite has a bachelor's degree in psychology and a master's degree in philosophy and religion, with a focus on women's spirituality. She recently completed her doctoral dissertation at the California Institute of Integral Studies. Its title is Bearing the Holy Ones, a Study of the Cult of Divine Birth in Ancient Greece. And by divine birth, Marguerite, I gather you refer specifically to virgin birth.
Yes. In the world in which Mary and Jesus emerged, there was a lot of belief in miraculous or unusual births. There were many claims that ancestral figures, as well as historical figures and political leaders from Egypt, all the way through Greece, and probably into West Asia as well, were born through various miraculous means.
So what kind of timeline are we talking about where we know that these virgin births or miraculous births took place?
Well, in Egypt, the beginning of the pharaonic period is approximately 3000 BC, more or less. And my understanding is that from the very beginning, it was claimed that the pharaohs were born miraculously from queens who had sex with gods that resulted in a conception. Now, in Egypt, part of the ritual involved the previous pharaoh, the living pharaoh, the man, who would have sex with the woman, but it was understood that he was sort of getting out of the way and the god was coming into his body, and that the conception that would occur was a result of the god and not the man interacting with the woman's body, and that then the next pharaoh would be born who was considered divine also himself, and that this is how the lineage of these divine kings continued. So we've got that. That's, you know, back to 3000 BCE. My work looks more at ancient Greece, but I'm looking more into the legendary period, which would be pre-1500 BCE, more or less.
Okay. We'll get to that period in a minute, but I wanted to ask you about the definition of virgin birth. It sounds like what you're talking about of miraculous birth in Egypt isn't the same as virgin birth. And today, I mean, when we talk about virgin birth, everybody starts thinking about hymens. And for us, in the last few centuries, virginity has been defined as having an intact hymen. So it seems like if you're going to have a virgin birth, there would be two problems to overcome. First, how to get inseminated without breaking the hymen, and then how to give birth without breaking it, which always seemed rather shocking to me. I guess unless you had cesarean. But is that the approach that the ancients took to virginity and virgin birth in the period that you were discussing?
Right. Well, it's a little bit complicated because when I started looking at all of these stories and histories, I determined that there were several methods of divine conception. Do you want me to sort of outline them? There are like three major ways.
Yeah, let's do that.
Okay. Well, the one for which we have the most documented evidence is the one that I discussed about ancient Egypt. And you have some instances of this in Greece, where it seems that what was happening was a sacred marriage union, in Greek known as hieros gamos, between the queen and the king. But, again, it was understood that the king was only a stand-in for the god, and that the conception was not really happening through him, but it was happening through the god. So that, I say, is a later stage of this whole miraculous or divine birth practice. prior to this, what I discern in the stories, and this is again now looking particularly at the Greek material, is this whole series of events where women seem to be described as having sex with gods without human males present, and it resulting in conception and birth, and that many of the major legendary figures and some of the living historical figures had legends of miraculous birth around them in this way. These were female figures who did not have sex with men, but with gods exclusively. So that might be suggesting a different method. And then I extrapolate back further, because those stories you see in the patriarchal period where the gods are taking precedence over the goddesses, and all the female figures are being rendered either wives or daughters of the god now, rather than authoritative virgin mothers themselves. So I extrapolate back, because I am a follower of the belief that there was an earlier period of matriarchy on the planet, and that prior to this sex with God method, there was a method of pure parthenogenesis in which women could train in this yoga, if you will, of learning how to give birth miraculously without having sex with men or with gods. It just coming out of them through these spiritual means that made them, the women, one with the creative goddess herself. So it put them on the par of divinity. So I see these three types of practices that we can go back to. That last one is my most conjectural.
I don't know if you are familiar with the work of Doris Lessing, who recently won the Nobel Prize for Literature. But one of her most recent books is called The Cleft, and in it she is going back through the voice of a Roman historian to look at a prehistoric time that was only recorded in oral history, according to her, in which females gave birth to females parthenogenetically and then suddenly started to give birth to males. And so there was a period of disturbance because they thought they'd given birth to monsters and so forth. And then eventually parthenogenetic births started to wane and births through conception increased. And she tells that story without any spiritual side of how the conception might have taken place. But you're saying possibly there was a method of parthenogenesis that was induced by practices.
Yes, and I do posit two different stages of the matriarchal, just as you have described Doris Lessing describing in presumably a fictional format, that first it was daughter-bearing, because naturally a woman will theoretically always give birth to a female if it's parthenogenetically conceived, because her egg only has female chromosomes. So I posit that there was a second phase of that pure parthenogenesis where somehow they managed to either figure out, Doris is saying that it was an anomaly, but I'm saying that it was deliberate, a method of figuring out how to produce males with the Y chromosome through this same pure parthenogenetic means. There was a lot of sort of grassroots literature in the late 70s and early 80s from the lesbian feminist community, which got very interested in this topic of parthenogenetic conception purely on the scientific level, on the biological level, really not talking about it as a spiritual practice, which is the way I'm talking about it. So there are a lot of speculations about what women's capacities might be purely on a biological level, but I just wish to distinguish that I'm talking about religiously induced parthenogenesis, and this is getting back to your idea of there having been a specific practice that women did in order to accomplish this.
So you think that this could actually happen. What leads you to believe that? Is it the historical record?
Right. It's interesting because in my dissertation, I actually don't try to make the argument that it was real and that it happened. I say that I believe that the Greeks thought it was real and that it happened. But if you ask me personally, I think the door does need to be open to this possibility.
Well, the Greeks weren't so dumb when it came to documenting natural events.
Right. And so your question was?
What makes you think that it might have really happened?
Right. Okay. The whole idea, first of all, came to me while I was working on my master's thesis about Demeter and Persephone, the mother-daughter goddesses. And I had a flash of intuition during that time that that mother-daughter conception right there was reflecting a pure parthenogenetic daughter-bearing mystery. And once that flash came to me, I began thinking, it just came to me, the idea that, oh my goodness, I think that women were actually trying this. And once that idea had gotten implanted in my mind, and then I went looking at the historical records of cult in ancient Greece, as well as the legendary and mythological stories, not discounting them as pure fiction, but considering that they might have more than kernels of historical truth in them. Once I started approaching those with that possibility, things started falling into remarkable patterns, and patterns that I didn't even expect. And I was able to construct what I believe were these various types of parthenogenetic priestesses, and just found that there was an enormous amount of material, an enormous number of myths attesting to such occurrences, as well as in the historical period, figures such as Alexander the Great, Pythagoras, Plato. They had miraculous birth stories surrounding them.
Oh my gosh, even as recently as Plato and Pythagoras, there were miraculous birth stories.
Yes, as recently as some of the Roman leaders, which I don't get to in my dissertation, so I'm not an expert on those. But so, you know, and this, of course, would have all been simultaneously with what was going on down in Egypt with these claims since 3000 BCE happening. So I was putting together all of these claims, be they from the historical record or the mythological record, and this amazing story started unfolding. I thought, wow, this has been right in front of our eyes all the time, and nobody's just laid these things side by side and begun to see the patterns.
Well, I want to talk to you some more about the patterns, but first, let me play devil's advocate for a minute and say, wasn't it enough simply that it was of great advantage to leaders and their followers to set themselves off from ordinary mortals? I mean, was this claim of virgin birth or miraculous birth really politically and socially useful? And to whom? I mean, what about did it serve the patriarchy?
Right. And that argument would be the typical Western rationalist view looking on this, that these are no more than fictional claims used to legitimize authority, right? But I'm flipping that argument around, and I'm saying, but gee, those claims didn't just come out of nowhere, perhaps. Let's trace them back, and let's sort of look at the volume of material and see what might really have been going on here. And when you do that, it starts to take the shape of something that was not necessarily fictional, but something that was very ancient, very anciently practiced. And again, yes, when it starts coming onto the record, we see it mostly as patriarchy using it to, you know, foster claims of divine birth and legitimizing kings' reigns and so forth and so on. But, you know, I think it depends on what viewpoint you're open to looking at it with. Do you want to just take the pure skeptical view, or do you want to open to some other possibilities here? Because when you do start opening to some other possibilities, as I said, the story just balloons out into something that has been right in front of our eyes the whole time.
Well, there certainly are a lot of other discoveries that have been made that were deemed impossible, so I certainly am not prepared to say that you are wrong about this.
Since this interview was recorded, Marguerite Rigoyoso has published three books. the cult of divine birth in ancient Greece, virgin mother goddesses of antiquity, and the mystery tradition of miraculous conception, Mary and the lineage of virgin births.
I would like to ask you some questions about, in particular, this cult of divine birth that you discuss in your work. And I gather that by cult you mean, at least in part, a group of actual women priestesses who collectively pursued some methodology for giving birth to heroes. And you also make a very bold statement that these women were foundational in the culture of Greece. So please, would you tell us how you know about these women?
Right. I started looking at the legends and the stories, these Greek stories about women having sex with gods, being raped by gods, and so forth. And I started discerning in that these were not just random stories, but that this must have been reflecting an underlying cult. Because so many of these women, when you look at their genealogy and so forth, they are somehow connected with a goddess in one way or another, which seems to indicate that they may have been priestesses of particular goddesses. Goddesses particularly like Hera, Athena, and Artemis. These are three, and Gaia. These are four of the major goddesses around which you have these female characters that get involved in these impregnation stories with gods, often against their will.
Mm.
So lead me back to the thread of your question.
Oh, okay. So, I was wondering how you got onto this idea of a particular impregnation cult of this type, and what are the pieces that you've put together to get this picture?
Right. You know, it was just piecing together all these stories and all of these legends around certain sacred sites like Delphi and Dodona. All of a sudden, when you start looking at the stories of the figures whose names are the ones that are used for these sites, for the mountains, for the caves, and so forth, the names are all either these women who gave birth miraculously or their children. So, you know, I looked at it and I said, something else deeper is going on here. And what I discerned is that there were these priestesses of these specific goddesses, Hera, Gaia, Artemis, and Athena, who in their earliest stages were dedicated to pure divine birth on behalf of these goddesses, because the story seemed to suggest that this was always a sacred activity. This wasn't just something people did every day as an alternate method of reproduction. It had a specific purpose, and the purpose was to bring in a high holy being. I discern in these stories the idea that for some reason it was not possible for humans of a certain divine nature to come in through regular sexual intercourse between a regular man and a woman. That there was something in this specialized, miraculous activity that was done with intention by women who were essentially yoginis or shamans, working at the highest levels of their craft, because this would have been the highest level of initiation open to any spiritual person on the planet, that through their intention and through their working with these other, you know, astral realms and their deities and so forth, they were bringing in special higher level beings that were thought to benefit the planet in some way. And so we have stories in the Christian tradition. This is Jesus. In the Greek tradition, we have Dionysus, Asclepius, and then we have legendary figures who were these heroes of Greek civilization. And almost, you know, when you look at the genealogies of these heroes, these ancient ancestral leaders who were the beginning points of royal lineages and so forth, almost down to a one, they have a divine birth story attached to them. So it seems to be that miraculous birth was some kind of mechanism for communicating with deities and bringing bringing special, almost superhuman type beings onto the planet, if you will. And under the best case scenario, that was to advance the evolution of the planet. And under the worst case scenario, it was to advance agendas that we might think of as not completely savory, such as the patriarchal agenda that had to do with a lot of warfare. And so you get Greek, quote, mythological heroes such as Heracles, Perseus, Theseus, and others who all have miraculous birth stories and then have these heinous stories of what they went about doing on the planet as ancestral figures of Greek civilization.
Now, do you have some kind of a sense of what they might actually have been doing? I mean, what was involved in this type of yoga or right. spiritual activity?
Right. Well, first of all, I think it's important to say that the way I'm conceiving this is it was a specialized spiritual activity that would have involved intensive training, just the way any yogi in India has to be trained. And by the way, these miraculous abilities have been attributed to yogis and shamans all over the planet, things like walking through walls, walking on water, changing your hair from gray to black, changing your metabolism, walking very rapidly through, you know, miles of space in very quick succession. So these attributes called siddhis have been supposedly attested to, for holy people in various traditions, Buddhist and Hindu and so forth. So my supposition is, wouldn't the ultimate siddhic ability have been miraculous birth? And the answer is yes, and that thus, for women, it was the only way open. And so how would they have done this? Well, you know, I don't get into a lot of that in the dissertation, but you get little hints of it in the mythologies. And one common motif you get is the flash of light. The flash of light that somehow hits the woman, presumably in the uterine area. The story of Io, Hera's priestess, who miraculously conceived the legendary Egyptian king Apophis through a union with Zeus. There is a legend connecting her with a flash or a ray of light coming from the heavens into her. We get this motif repeated in the stories and the paintings of Mary. Mary's conception is sometimes conceived of as a ray of light. So this leads you to say, so if they were working in trance, presumably, you know, this is not like somebody's just going to sit down and miraculously conceive. This would be a focused activity, I would presume, under trance. They must have been working with certain principles of light and energy and photons and electrons, and, you know, down to the building blocks of matter itself, I would think, not to mention DNA. And it's interesting because in the laboratory, chemical means for inducing parthenogenetic, in other words, virgin conception of eggs in both animals and humans has involved heat, shock, and chemicals to get it started. So this makes me think, you know, were these women working somehow with the heat in their body, conceived of as light or what have you? I also think that another method to induce their trance may have involved sacred medicines, what we would call hallucinogens or entheogens. And I do find evidence that they were using things like marijuana, the priestesses of Hera, that was a plant that was sacred to her, the Delphic Oracle, where I find lots of stories of miraculous birth in the toponyms and place names there. The Delphic Oracle, there are many descriptions of what seemed to be her getting very much drugged up before she was going on that tripod and prophesying. And one of the drugs that seemed to come up was this hallucinogenic vapor that at the time was coming through the earth itself, but she was also chewing laurel leaves, she was breathing in fumes from a fire that might have had hemp seeds, and so forth.
Huh. I did want to ask you about one other thing that's related to this, because I heard you on another radio programming discussing someone who could restore women to a state of virginity, and you said that it wasn't a physical virginity, it was something else. And I wonder if you mind explaining that to the Wings listeners.
Yes, because this gets back to your original question that I never quite answered about virginity being the hymen that was intact. Virginity, I think, in the Greek time, meant, yes, a woman who was celibate, who had not had sex with men, or who could energetically restore that state, and this is getting to your question. I have worked with a shaman from India. His name is Nandu Menon, and he has a couple of books published in this country. He does workshops with women on their reproductive functions and the energy streams that surround the uterus and so forth. He said to me that, and he told our whole seminar, that you can do what's called energetically restoring virginity to a womb by doing certain rituals and healings and banishments of energies that have come into the universe, into the uterus, or things that have happened. He does this in cases of abortion. He does this in cases of rape, where through his trance state, through his laying on of hands, whatever other kinds of methods he does, he clears the energy of a woman's uterus of this sort of previous entry of a male's energy into it, thereby being able to restore the intact aura, if you will, around the uterus, which amounts to restoring the virginity of the uterus and the vagina.
Wow. I'm sorry to say that that's all the time that we have. My guest has been Dr. Marguerite Rigoglioso, a recently minted PhD from the California School of Integral Studies. Her dissertation is titled Bearing the Holy Ones, A Study of the Cult of Divine Birth in Ancient Greece. Just one last question. Has doing this research changed you in any way, Marguerite?
Well, yes, it has. It's made me look at women's capacities, women's spiritual capacities, much differently. It's made me look at the Christian mystery of Mary's virgin birth much differently. It's really helped sort of lift the veil off my eyes of what may have been going on deep in our history and the role of women in the evolution of the planet. So there are many implications and ripples that will have in my life and hopefully in the lives of others.
Thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome, and thank you very much for having me.
Since this interview was recorded, Marguerite Rigoglioso has published 3 books, The Cult of Divine Birth in Ancient Greece, Virgin Mother Goddesses of Antiquity, and The Mystery Tradition of Miraculous Conception, Mary and the Lineage of Virgin Births. She has also created the Seven Sisters Mystery School for restoring the ancient way of the priestess. To hear Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org or check our page at facebook.com/wingsradio. Wings thanks all our supporters, including your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen and Genevieve Vaughn, whose works can be found through the website gifteconomy.com. That's gift-economy.com. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.